Welcome to the online dental mentoring service, where Dr. Derry Rogers and Associate Professor Michael Stubbs present clinical overviews and speak to dental leaders on the developing areas of modern day practice to assist you to develop and grow yours. Visit onlinedentalmentoring.com for more podcasts and training videos, all available free to our subscribers. We hope you enjoy today's show. Well, hi to all our listeners again. We hope you're enjoying our free series of podcasts. Today, we're going to discuss soft tissue screening with Associate Professor Michael Stubbs, and we'll be sharing with you the process in which he routinely screens both extraoral and intraoral issues. Now, Michael, we all know as dentists how to examine a patient dentally, but from an oral medicine perspective, what's the process that you undertake when examining a new patient?
Well, Derry, look, I think the best way is to follow a routine, and that way it becomes synonymous with every patient. So it becomes almost like an involuntary process. And I always start by taking a mental note. When I say hi to the patient, how are you? I'm checking out their facial features to see if there's any evidence of facial asymmetry or swelling. You know, this can be very relevant when we consider asymmetry might be an asymptomatic parotid gland enlargement or even evidence of a facial or dental infection. And it lends itself to asking questions like, hi, I noticed the right side of your face looks a little bit puffier than the left. Have you ever noticed this before? You know, it lends itself into the conversation that the patient may or may not necessarily have observed themselves. And you might also ask the question, you know, just from the fact that maybe one side is slightly larger, such as the masseter muscles, might be slightly hypertrophic. Do you experience any pain or aggravation when you're chewing your food, for example? So simple conversation, simple questioning. And I know we like to greet our patients in a friendly way, but, you know, the moment the patient walks into your examination room, you're examining them. And I always begin...
Mike, sorry, just as a question there. If someone says, well, when I chew food normally, I have some awareness, are you looking for having issues with hard food like steak or bagels, or is it just any food?
Yeah, I think you're pretty much looking at things like the hardness or texture of food. So, for instance, as you rightly say, imagine eating a bagel or even a piece of steak, particularly a poorer cut steak, which is quite tough. You know, it might indicate the patient has some issues such as masseter pain, TMJ pain, but it may also indicate the patient's got a cracked cusp. And, you know, just simplistic conversation like that gets the grey cells actually in the brain working.
So you're delineating between dental cause of pain, muscular cause of pain, and joint cause of pain.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's actually interesting you ask that question because, you know, let's imagine a patient said, well, as a matter of fact, I do find my jaw gets painful when I'm chewing. You might, the next question is, does it ever get tired? If it gets tired when they're chewing, you start to think muscular pain. If, for example, they say no, but as a matter of fact, I find that every so often I'm chewing on my left side, on my right side, and suddenly I get jolts of pain when I'm chewing. You might be thinking food impaction or particularly cracked cusp. And remember, at this stage, you haven't even examined the patient in the mouth anyway.
But at least it's a good screening process before moving down to the soft tissue issues that, as we've said, may have been referred to you, but delineating out the extracapsular, intracapsular and dental causes.
Yeah, absolutely. And it also lends itself to the conversation about, now, in my specialty, I do go through a rigorous process of examining every patient the same. And the reason I do that is because I know a patient's referred to me for a particular problem, but my responsibility is to actually review all the potential problems that may exist, whether they were diagnosed by the colleague or they weren't diagnosed. And as a dentist, when you examine your patient, one of the things you're doing, particularly for your routine examinations every 6 or 12 months, you're getting an idea of how the masticatory mechanism is operating. And it's not just obviously in referencing the dentition. And so looking at the musculature element, looking at the TMJ element, looking at the potential for anatomy and saying, well, you know, the patient does have a little bit of asymmetry facially, or there might be a history of swelling. The patient may even say something like, well, as a matter of fact, I've noticed this swelling on my left or right side of my face in the last few days. It then lends itself to questioning, why is the swelling there? Does it get worse when you're eating? Why would it get worse when you're eating? Because it might be a salivary gland issue. It could be an infection-related issue. And so when the patient sits in the chair, what I do is I always start by palpating the temporomandibular joints. And I'm particularly interested to see if there's any pain on palpation. And when they open and close the mouth, I always measure the mouth opening. Now you might ask, well, what's the normal range for mouth opening? Well, we deem it as 36 to 52 millimeters. So if I have a patient, let's say, where I'm measuring and they open 25 millimeters and I say, can you open any wider? And they say no. Straight away you start to think, well, is there a reason for this, such as internal derangement? Do we have a condylar disc structural change relationship? We call that a closed lock, where the disc is actually interfering with condylar movement. Do we have an elongated coronoid process? You know, is there an issue where perhaps the masseter muscles particularly are protecting the TMJ and consequently the patient can't open their mouth? And we call that, of course, trismus. And, you know, yet other extremes ends of the population, such as what I call hyperextenders. Now, I've got patients, I've got some that can open 65 millimetres. That's the maximum I've ever had. And I often jokingly say to them, you know, if there was an Olympics for mouth opening, you'd be getting the gold medal there because that's a pretty significant mouth opening. It lends itself to conditions like hypermobility, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. You know, at Marfan's. But, you know, these are the things that you think about, certainly I think about, just in simply examining the joint and getting them to open and close the mouth. You're also interested in having a look at the deviation, if anything, of the mandible. Look at the chin movement. Are they opening correctly straight? Is the chin deflecting to the left or the right? So, for instance, if the chin is deflecting to the left, you'd be thinking there's a restriction in the left joint compared to the right. Relevancy might be something like, well, the right side might be clicking more. The patient might say, well, as a matter of fact, I notice my right side of my jaw joint is actually quite sore. That's because it's hyperextending. How's it doing that? Because the patient, as they open their mouth, the relationship between the condyle and the fossa and the disc that sits normally between the two structures may be interfering with the movement of the left side, resulting in restriction of movement of that chin, and opening further makes the right side have to work hyperextend. You know, palpate the muscles, masseter and temporalis. You know, do it bilaterally. I always recommend start with your fingers on the lower border of the mandible towards where we would delineate buccinator and submentalis meet. So that means, roughly speaking, around the angle of the lower lip, but on the border of the mandible. And then you start to work your fingers backwards towards the gonial angle. And you do that because you get a gradient, which means as you palpate, the patient might say, yeah, that's okay, that's okay. And as you work your way to the masseter muscles, they might say, actually, that's a bit uncomfortable, that's painful. If you go straight to the masseter, you often find patients sometimes say, well, that's not sore at all. But in fact, it's not sore because you've just pushed on that structure. So you can do a gradient to give someone an opportunity, a patient, to experience what you might consider non-painful before you get to the painful areas. And check out the temporalis muscle. You know, palpate the temple region. Very easy to do. And in reality, what you're doing is you're just establishing, in fact, if there is any pain on palpation. Interesting question. If the temporalis is painful, ask the question, do you get headaches? People might say, and, you know, a lot of patients do, they use the term migraine very loosely. Oh, yes, I get migraines. How often do you get a migraine? Oh, every day. Well, I think, folks, we know that migraines don't necessarily occur daily. And migraines, as you know, are a particular headache, which is a neurovascular headache. And so as a result, you'd ask questions like, you know, do you find that your light becomes very painful when you have these headaches? Photophobia. Do you find your sense of hearing increases? Phonophobia. Do you get a stiff neck and nausea? They're classic migrainous symptoms, as well as an aura in about 15% of cases. A musculoskeletal pain, musculoskeletal headaches, is quite a different conversation. And see, again, you've just palpated three structures and got them to open their mouth, and you've already, before you've even looked in their mouth, started to establish if there's a functional issue problem, and maybe this patient has temporomandibular disorder. And then,
so Mike, we've gone through the external side now. When you start to go inside, where do you start? What's the system that you have for examining the intraoral structures in a systematized way?
Well, again, you know, look, I'm a creature of habit. So I start on the right side, buccal mucosa, and then I work my way around the mouth. So usually what I'll do is I'll actually describe to the patient out loud what I'm looking at, and I'll say, buccal mucosa on the right is fine, working towards the labial mucosa, evaluating the right mandibular gingiva both posteriorly and anteriorly, and then working my way to the left buccal mucosa, left buccal gingiva, then moving my way up to the maxillary gingiva, upper lip, and then the right side of the maxillary gingiva. And then what I do is I then look at the palate, and then I move my way in to get them to poke their tongue out and look at the dorsal surface, lateral surface, right and left, and then always checking ventral surface and floor of mouth. Now, one of the reasons we know this is important because we understand that high-risk sites for cancer, squamous cell carcinoma to be exact, is typically lateral ventral surface of tongue, floor of mouth, and the retropharyngeal region, retromolar region we talk about, but it's really retropharyngeal. And so they're the sites that you want to check. And if you go through this process, you actually are automatically within a period of, say, 5 minutes total time from examining the TMJ, working your way through the mucosa, you've actually really critically evaluated that patient's soft tissue hard structures before you even get to the dentition. I also encourage you to palpate the lips. So you put your forefinger on the inside of the lip, your thumb on the outside, gloved, of course, and you're gently palpating the structures. And what you're doing is you're feeling for lumps or bumps. Sometimes patients might have, let's say, a polyp or a mucosal in their lower lip. It's a minor saliva gland problem. They might even have a firm swelling in the upper lip. Could be a minor saliva gland tumor. And so you're actually evaluating that individual really thoroughly before you actually get to the teeth.
Great. So let's go to dry mouth, xerostomia. When we're looking inside there, and obviously it's going to have an impact upon the tissue that we see, how do you classify dry mouth, Michael? Somebody comes in with a level of anxiety seeing somebody like yourself or a new dentist for the first time. How do you delineate between the anxiety-created dry mouth and real dry mouth?
Well, it's a good question because, look, dry mouth has two elements, doesn't it? One is subjective, one's objective. So subjectively, sometimes patients don't even realize they have a dry mouth. They may, in fact, there's a certain threshold that I believe physiologically patients don't even appreciate. Their mouth is not so moist. And so when you look at the tissues, if you see, for example, dry tissues, the dental mirror sticks to the buccal mucosa or the tongue, when you're examining them, you start to appreciate the fact that this patient has dryness. You may also consider looking at the medical history and looking at associated medications that can range from certain types of antidepressants like amitriptyline, which is NDEP as a brand name, right through to antihypertensives, could be antihistamines. So in other words, medications can dry them as well. But the other thing that's interesting, you're right, Derry, anxiety is a big issue. And obviously when you meet a patient for the first time, and some of us who particularly do a lot of public speaking, we often find our mouths dry, sympathetic nervous system overdrive. And so what you can do is get the gauze and simply place it on the anterior floor of mouth and palpate the submandibular glands. You can very quickly determine a patient who's got a dry mouth because they're nervous versus a patient who's got a dry mouth because they can't make saliva. And some of our listeners might be thinking about Sjogren's syndrome, which, as you know, is an autoimmune condition. You'd ask the question, do you have dry, gritty eyes? Because usually a patient who will comment on dry, gritty eyes, again, you might draw your attention towards potentially an autoimmune cause. The other thing I often do is you simply evert the lower lip and you watch the development of the pools of saliva on the labial mucosa from the minor saliva gland. So in other words, observe that tissue for 15 seconds and see if, in fact, you develop saliva droplets or not. If you don't, then you're looking at a patient who's got a dry mouth. You can do an objective measure, which is where, GC, for example, do a saliva test, which is available for dentists can purchase for their practices. And they actually, the patient literally chews a rather benign and rather banal tasting little bit of wax, and they dribble into a cup for 5 minutes. Now, by definition, xerostomia is defined as over a five-minute period, you make less than 0.7 mils per minute when you're stimulating, such as chewing. So just doing something simple like that also validates the fact the patient has a dry mouth.
So, Mike, when we talk about dry mouth, one of the other issues that we start to see is teeth erosion, whether it be dietary-related, I guess gourd-related or whatever, and there's more and more of these types of conditions I'm seeing in my younger patients. It must have an impact on soft tissue, but how do you start to screen for those types of things as
well? Yeah, well, one of the things too is gastric esophageal reflux disease or gourd can be silent, which means a patient might even realise when they're sleeping at night that they're regurgitating acid into their mouth. And so you might ask the question, for example, do they wake with a burning throat in the morning? Do they wake with an acidic taste in their mouth? During the course of the day, people know what heartburn is. Heartburn really is epigastric pain, which is basically acidic production in the stomach. But what you can do is sometimes getting an ENT to visualize the back of the nose with the nasoendoscopy, the camera. They often see scarring where the esophagus joins the pharynx. And that's usually a good characteristic feature of a patient who's got silent reflux, especially if they don't know they've got reflux. Patients will also know or notice that certain things like wine, red wine especially, chocolate, certain food types make their themselves feel very uncomfortable. And so they may already be on an anti-reflux medication. As a dentist, what you might do is if you suspect erosion from the stomach is actually part of the issue and the patient's on an anti-reflux medication, most times they take it in the morning. Get them to take it at night time. Because, you know, you might find, in fact, that when people lie flat in the bed, often the reflux might be an issue because of that as well. So actually taking their anti-reflux medication in the evening is preferable. Of course, you can check with their GP, but most GPs would say, well, as long as they're taking their 20 or 40 milligrams of propantasazole or Somac or Nexium or any of the other brands, Pariet is another brand name, as far as they're concerned, as long as they're taking their medication, that's all that matters. But you can target the dosage timing based on what you suspect might be an issue with reflux.
Mike, some fantastic points there. And I think this leads us on to our next podcast, which will be coming up, which is oral cancer screening. So until next time, it's goodbye from me.
Goodbye from me.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and invite you to visit onlinedentalmentoring.com to subscribe to access more free podcasts in our video library and also be able to submit your questions for our panel discussion podcasts. And remember, tell your colleagues about us if you feel they'd benefit from the information that we've presented. Until next podcast, take care.